Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 441, titled Pecunia Nervus Belli, Part 2. This is being recorded on January 11th of the year 2004. Before I begin, let me remind you that sister station WFMU-FM is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery, D-A-V-E-E-M-O-R-Y. Older programs are available for download only at a longer URL linked to both the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. Within a week or so of the airing of this broadcast, there will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of For the Record program number 441 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. Spitfire handles all of the various programs and lectures I've done over the years. You can contact them at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, B-E-N-L-O-M-O-N-D, two words, and the zip code is 95005. The email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. I get no money whatsoever from the arrangement with Spitfire. The most recently recorded pair of half-hour segments are available for download only on Real Audio on the Spitfire website. Now, this broadcast, again, Pecunia Nervus Belli Part 2, is a follow-up to For the Record program number 407. The phrase, the title phrase, is Latin for money is the sinew of war. That's a quote that I've usually seen attributed to Tacitus. I've seen it attributed to other classical commentators as well, but I believe it was Tacitus. What we're going to be doing in this program is taking a look at the events in and around September 11th, and we're going to be taking a look at some of the economic impact, and I'm going to attempt to clarify what I believe is going on with this very complicated unfolding of events. I believe that the events in and around September 11th constitute the climax, the culmination of some very important and very powerful historical, political, and economic trends. And I do not think that this is an event and a situation that can be simplified. Indeed, I think one of the problems in understanding September 11th, aside from the fact that there has been considerable official obfuscation, is that it is a complicated event, and unfortunately the American people are not a particularly complicated set of intellects at this point. So I'm going to attempt to clarify things somewhat. Some of the program will be new, and some of it will be by way of review. In terms of analyzing some of the economic aspects of September 11th, there are many other programs that deal with the economic aspects of these events. A few of them off the top of my head, For the Record 344 through 346, For the Record 365, 366, and 372, For the Record 407, and For the Record 412 go into the economic aspects of the situation. So does FTR 377. Now, this is the events of September 11th have been oversimplified and perhaps understandably so. I'm going to attempt to stitch together a few quotes which will perhaps give us an understanding of what is taking place in intuitive as well as historical sense as well. I believe that the events in and around September 11th, including the war in Iraq, is the culmination of a series of events of which the Second World War was a major part, but which involves globalization, a phenomenon that is widely perceived, correctly perceived to be underway, but which is in fact something that has been underway for a long time. I believe that globalization is being formalized and institutionalized, but one of the obstacles to understanding, in my opinion, is the fact that globalization has been taking place for some time. It was underway in a big way in the aftermath of World War I, and World War II was itself, in a politico-economic sense, a culmination, or an outgrowth of globalization. I'm going to attempt to explain that. I think that many analysts have grasped a part of this particular elephant, but rather like the three blind men who grabbed part of the elephant. One grabbed the trunk and had one impression of it. One grabbed the leg and had another impression of it. And yet a third grabbed the tail and had a different impression of it. I think in that context, a lot of people have been perceiving part of this whole and then assuming that the whole itself was like that particular part. That's not the case. I'm going to do my best to clarify the situation in the context of this broadcast, but understand that in a sense I'm undertaking the impossible. So please utilize the Spitfire website, including and especially FTR 391, which is a breakdown and detailed description of September 11th with references not only to other broadcasts, but also with links to various articles that are key to understanding this. We're going to begin by reviewing a piece of text that was included in, among other programs, For the Record 359. This is from an article called The Swastika and the Crescent by Martin A. Lee, the author of, among other titles, The Beast Reawakens. This is from the Southern Poverty Law Center's intelligence report, Spring of 2002. And this is a vision that Adolf Hitler relayed to Albert Speer, the armaments minister of the Third Reich, during the closing days of Nazi Germany, or at least in its overground, above-ground manifestation. Quote, "As Germany's defeat loomed during the final months of World War II, Adolf Hitler increasingly lapsed into delusional fits of fantasy. Albert Speer, in his prison writings, recounts an episode in which a maniacal Hitler, quote, pictured for himself and for us the destruction of New York City in a hurricane of fire." Unquote. The Nazi Führer described skyscrapers turning into gigantic burning torches, collapsing one upon another, the glow of the exploding city illuminating the dark sky. Unquote. An approximation of Hitler's hellish vision came true on September 11th, when terrorists destroyed the Twin Towers in New York, killing nearly 3,000 people. And again, as Martin Lee has noted, that delusional fit of fantasy on Hitler's part, to a certain extent, did come true on September 11th. Contemporary domestic Nazi elements utilize a series of novels that were written by William Pierce, a former member of the American Nazi Party, who later branched off and founded his own domestic Nazi organization, the National Alliance. In the past, I've referenced the book Serpent's Walk that was published by National Vanguard Books. In addition, Pierce himself has authored The Turner Diaries, the role model for the Nazi terror group The Order that killed Alan Berg in the 1980s, as well as for Timothy McVeigh and Company in the Oklahoma City bombing. Those books, along with novels like Hunter, are basically manifestos. They're far more than the novels they appear to be. They're basically teaching tools and political manifestos for the contemporary Nazi movement. We're going to take a look at the culminating chapter, or the culminating event, in the Turner Diaries. The Turner Diaries was authored by William Pierce, who wrote under the pen name of Andrew MacDonald. And interestingly enough, the culminating event in the Turner Diaries is a low-level suicide aerial attack on the Pentagon by members of the Order, the Nazi group that ultimately winds up precipitating a takeover of the United States. Interestingly enough, after a series of devastating terrorist acts that they launch involving nuclear weapons and other instruments of mass destruction, in Serpent's Walk, the Nazi takeover of the United States in the mid-21st century also follows the devastation of the United States with wet terrorist incidents using weapons of mass destruction. The climactic episode in the Turner Diaries, again a low-level suicide aerial attack on the Pentagon, is described as follows. And the I here is Earl Turner, the fictional protagonist of the Turner Diaries. "I conferred privately with Major Williams of the Washington Field Command for more than an hour of the problem of attacking the Pentagon. The military's other major command centers were either knocked out on September 8th or subsequently consolidated with the Pentagon, which the top brass apparently regard as impregnable. And it damn near is. We went over every possibility we could think of, and we came up with no really convincing plan except perhaps one. That is to make an air delivery of a bomb. In the massive ring of defenses around the Pentagon, there is a great deal of anti-aircraft firepower, but we decided that a small plane flying just above the ground might be able to get through the 3-mile gauntlet with one of our 60-kiloton warheads. One factor in favor of such an attempt is that we have never before used aircraft in such a way, and we might hope to catch the anti-aircraft crews off their guard. Although the military is guarding all civil airfields, it just happens that we have an old crop duster stashed in a barn only a few miles from here. My immediate assignment is to prepare a detailed plan for an aerial attack on the Pentagon by next Monday. We must make a final decision at the time, and then without further delay. November 9, 1993. It's still 3 hours until first light, and all systems are go. I'll use the time to write a few pages, my last diary entry. Then it's a one-way trip to the Pentagon for me. The warhead is strapped into the front seat of the old Stearman crop duster and rigged to detonate either on impact or when I flip a switch in the back seat. Hopefully, I'll be able to manage a low-level airburst directly over the center of the Pentagon. Failing that, I'll at least try to fly as close as I can before I'm shot down. It's been more than 4 years since I've flown, but I've thoroughly familiarized myself with the Stearman cockpit and been briefed on the plane's peculiarities. I don't anticipate any piloting problems. The barn hangar here is only 8 miles from the Pentagon. We'll thoroughly warm up the engine in the barn, and when the door is opened, I'll go like a bat out of hell straight for the Pentagon at an altitude of about 50 feet. And skipping down, thus end Earl Turner's diaries, as unpretentiously as they began. His final mission was successful, of course, as we are all reminded each year on November 9th, our traditional Day of the Martyrs. So again, the culminating event in the Turner Diaries, the contemporary Mein Kampf for the Nazi movement in America, a low-level suicide aerial attack on the Pentagon. I would note in passing that Mohammed Atta and company were inquiring about obtaining crop-dusting planes, ostensibly for distributing CBW weapons. A crop-duster, by the way, is very maneuverable and can fly very low to the ground, thus making aerial interception extremely difficult, and even at the relatively low speed of 150 miles an hour or so, traversing a ground-based anti-aircraft weapon of any type in order to anticipate the approach of an aircraft like that and shoot it down is all but impossible. You know how fast a car goes at 150 miles an hour? Well, at treetop level, 150 miles an hour is very fast indeed. By way of presenting a few items that will give people an understanding of September 11th and related matters in sort of an abbreviated but concrete sense, I'm going to also repeat a portion of text that I read in For the Record Program 372 and in For the Record 412 as well. There has been a fair amount of discussion among alternative political circles of September 11th as a provocation in order to justify the expansion of American empire, imperialism, etc. That is not, strictly speaking, true, although I suspect that some of the elements that are being manipulated at the higher levels in connection with what is taking place in the United States are of such a mind, specifically elements associated with the petroleum industry as well. What we're going to talk about next is the subversion of France prior to and during World War II. France in the 1930s had been governed by the Popular Front under Léon Blum, a mixture of sincerely democratic with small d elements, involving relatively conservative social democrats as well as communist and socialist elements as well. Many elements of the French power elite, members of the armed forces, the aristocracy, the church, and in particular high rollers in the French industry and finance, were far more worried about their own countrymen and women than they were about German and Italian fascists. Indeed, in For the Record Program number 372, I go into the links between French industrialists and financiers and their German counterparts. because those structural economic relationships, analogous in certain respects to the structural economic relationships between the Bush administration, the Republican Party, the petroleum industry, and some of the elites of the Middle Eastern oil-producing kingdoms, the very elites that have also helped to finance al-Qaeda, those structural economic relationships are paramount and deemed paramount, and the consequences, often negative, of those structural economic relationships for the country to which they ostensibly owe allegiance is something that does not particularly bother people in the Bush administration and the oil industry. And I think that in order to understand September 11th, one should understand that what is taking place is far more like the subversion of France prior to and during World War II. It should be noted, and as we're going to see, and we're going to be reviewing information presented at greater length and in greater detail in FTR 372, elements of the French power elite were well aware of Germany's plans to wage war on France, but because of the economic relationships between the French power elite and some of their German compatriots, in particular links between the steel cartel in its French manifestation and the German members of the steel cartel, the French power elite actively anticipated the German invasion and saw the German invasion as something to be collaborated with, and in turn, that invasion was realized as successfully as it was in considerable measure because of the subversion of France, its armed forces, and its citizenry by that power elite. I believe that what is taking place in connection with September 11th is analogous. This is not, in my opinion, something that is going to work out for the expansion of American empire or imperialism, although I believe that there are elements in this country that are deluded into thinking in that regard. But rather, I think that what is taking place in connection with September 11th marks not only an all-out assault on the United States by hostile foreign elements, but subversion from within, both politically and economically and militarily, by elements that are in league with an underground Reich and indeed an underground Axis. The German invasion of France in World War II was not a provocation, and it was not intended to expand French empire. It was anticipated, it was collaborated with, and brought to fruition by a domestic fifth column, again linked economically and politically with the invaders. But so too, I think that September 11th should be understood not as a provocation to expand American empire, but as something that, if it comes to fruition, will mark the destruction and or subjugation of the United States politically, physically, and or economically, as the case may be. We're going to talk about globalization and its implications in just a minute. But first, I'm going to read some sections from a book that I accessed at considerable length, and for the record, 372. This book is called Triumph of Treason. It was authored by Pierre Cot, COT, who was the French Minister of Aviation under the Social Front of the Social Front under Léon Blum. This book was published in hardcover by Ziff Davis and was copyrighted 1944. So this book was published while World War II was still underway. Please note here that, as was the case with September 11th, there were warnings all along about what was going to happen. The French power elite actively collaborated with and helped to realize the subversion of France. But again, the German invasion of France in World War II wasn't a provocation, and it was not something intended to realize the expansion of French empire. On the contrary, it marked the formal subjugation of France as an economic and political entity to the German elements of this international structural economic structure. Indeed, some of the collaboration between France and Germany in the years 2000 in connection with the war in Iraq and other things is a reflection of the economic dominance of France by Germany. There's a joke going around with it. France has a new name, West Germany. Anyway, turning to Triumph of Treason by Pierre Cot, in order to understand one of the most complex aspects of September 11th, let's take a look at what happened to France in the run-up to World War II. Again, I'm putting an awful lot in a very short period of time. Much more detailed discussion can be found in For the Record 372 and in For the Record 412 and in Miscellaneous Archive Show M61, available from Spitfire. Writing in 1944, former French aviation minister Pierre Cot described the activities of the fifth column that brought down France as follows. The activity of the fifth column will not be considered by historians as a special phenomenon of French public life, but as an integral part of fascism. The fifth column has appeared wherever fascism has tried to gain a foothold. It was at work in Spain, Austria, and Czechoslovakia before it turned up in France, and there are fifth columns in the United States, India, and Latin America. By the fifth column, I do not mean only spies and licensed traitors. The fifth column includes all who, by accepting fascist doctrines or methods, become the conscious or unconscious accomplices of a foreign power. Treason and complicity have their degrees and nuances. By the way, before I continue here, please note that Pierre Cot notes not only the role of anti-communism in helping to recruit fifth columnists on the right, but also noting, and remember at this point in time, 1940, when Germany invaded France, the Hitler-Stalin Pact was in effect, and at that point the world's communist parties began to espouse basically what was a pro-German line. And indeed, there are, I believe, elements within the so-called progressive forces in the United States that could be viewed as analogous to those members of the French Communist Party who were espousing a pro-German line and saw the expansion of Germany as a defense against British imperialism. Indeed, I think some of the elements that are collaborating in what could be described as sort of combined anti-American and anti-Semitic Yaquiite fifth column in the United States are mouthing similar platitudes about American imperialism and are ultimately going to wind up contributing, perhaps unwittingly in many cases, to the subversion of the United States. I also think that there are elements in the petroleum industry who do indeed intend to use American military power to establish hegemony. We're going to talk about the Peloponnesian War later, and one of the principles, I think, that is dictating the subversion and the war against the United States. Returning once again to Triumph of Treason by Pierre Cot, treason and complicity have their degrees and nuances. The general staff of the fifth column consists principally of ambitious men who try to seize power by destroying or paralyzing the democratic system. The body of the fifth column is composed of people who think they are saving their country from the communist menace, unquote, or from British imperialism, unquote, and who do not know in whose favor their actions are operating. Through hate of the Popular Front, good Frenchmen, or men who consider themselves such, served Hitler gratuitously by doing work to which they would never have consented had they been offered payment. Why? Because they detested the Republic and democracy more than they loved France. They accepted the idea of the defeat as a necessary evil which permitted them to rid France of the democratic system and to keep in power in the neighboring countries the fascist dictators whom they considered solely capable of maintaining order in Europe. They afterwards became unconscious collaborators of these dictators. They thought they were doing their duty in letting Hitler free France from the Judeo-Masonic influence, unquote, and Europe from the communist peril. These people who had never read Marx considered the Marxist danger more immediate than the Hitlerian. They preferred the risks of an entente with a victorious Hitler to the risks of a democratic victory that would cause the collapse of the fascist dictators in Europe. Considering Hitler in Germany, Mussolini in Italy, and Franco in Spain as knights of an anti-Bolshevist crusade, they became precursors and later partisans of collaboration with Hitler's new order, unquote. The history of the fifth column in France, before, during, and after the armistice of June 1940, cannot be written for some years to come. The trial of the fifth column is the trial for treason which the French people will inevitably demand. Bear in mind that, again, Pierre Cot was the former French Minister of Aviation, and he was writing in 1944. Continuing. Enough evidence has already been published to prove that France was stabbed in the back by those who saw in Hitler the new St. George who would slay the communist dragon. When Pierre Lazareff, former editor-in-chief of Paris Soir, the French newspaper with the widest circulation, reports royalists as saying, quote, "We need the defeat to wipe out the Republic," unquote, when Élie Bois, former editor of the Petit Parisien, the most influential political newspaper, reports great industrialists as admitting to him during the winter of 1939-40 that a plot had been organized to replace the democratic regime by a, quote, "government of authority," unquote, and that this plot presupposed a Nazi victory. When Anatole de Monzy writes in a book passed by the censor of the Vichy government that Maréchal Pétain said in February of 1940, quote, "They will appeal to me in the third week in May," unquote, when Genevieve Tabouy tells of the work accomplished in the Parisian salons by the 5th Column's Brigade Mondaine, when Henri de Kerelis, former officer and nationalist deputy, exposes the inroads of the 5th Column in the conservative and military circles which he knew, when Henri Torres reveals to us what was going on in the offices of the official propaganda, we have every reason to accept their affirmations, which tally so perfectly with the events. Now, let me stress that any historical analogy is, of course, necessarily imperfect in certain respects, but I think those who, perhaps quite understandably, given the official dissembling and given the lack of good information that's available about the nature of fascism and the nature of current political events, those who see in September 11th only a provocation are making a serious mistake. For what is intended, I believe, and what has taken place is not the expansion of American empire, but the subjection and or destruction of the United States politically, economically, or, if need be, physically. And I think that the French subversion prior to and during World War II is the relevant role model. And what we're going to do in side two of this broadcast is to examine globalization. This is a phenomenon that people believe is relatively new, but in fact, in order to understand what is taking place in the world and what I believe is coming to fruition now, it's important to understand that globalization has been underway for some time. Let's perhaps conclude this side with a thumbnail sketch of what has taken place in terms of geopolitics and economics in this century. In World War I, the established order, basically, Europe committed suicide, economically and politically. The long, drawn-out conflict not only annihilated the industrial labor forces of the major powers of Europe, but it also destroyed them economically as well. The Hohenzollern and Romanov dynasties, the Ottoman Empire, and the Habsburg dynasty all collapsed. The old order in Europe, the order that had stood for hundreds of years, collapsed. The United States, on the other hand, entered that war very late, and so the United States was the only intact economic and manufacturing power on Earth. And that set the stages for the first major manifestation of what I believe to be the current manifestation of globalization. And it is in the context of these capital flows, these tides of capital flow, that we can, I think, best understand what is taking place in the United States today. WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs, more recent programs streaming at wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word. Older programs are available at a longer URL, linked to both the wfmu.org/Dave Emery website and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. There will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of For the Record program number 441 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website within a week or so of the airing of this program. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 441, Pecunia Nervus Belli, part two, being recorded on January 11th of 2004. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.